Welcome to Dear Prudence. I'm your Prudence, Janae Desmond-Harris. Today we'll be discussing an international sister's trip gone awry and a husband's struggle to live with his wife's mental health issues. Helping me out today is the writer and mental health advocate, Bassi Ikpe. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling essay collection, I'm Telling the Truth But I'm Lying, and the Audible original, Home Rarely Feels Like This. She's also the creator of No Shame Day, an initiative that normalizes conversations around Black mental health in order to reduce stigma. Bassi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
I'm thrilled that you're here. And before we dive into these letters, which I know you said in an email, a couple of them already pissed you off, so I can't wait to hear your reactions. I want to go ahead and ask you for one piece of unsolicited advice that you just want to get off your chest.
One of the pieces of advice that I've carried with me forever is never apologize for how you choose to take care of yourself. But within reason, because I think a lot of people take that and run like, I'll never have to apologize. No, within reason.
Okay.
So that's something that I live by.
What are the limits on within reason?
Well, the limits with everything, I think that people sort of like take advice and then internalize it in a way that's very selfish, where it's like, if I'm doing something that harms you, I apologize. Like I'm not, that has nothing to do with how I'm taking care of myself. It's how I'm attacking you in a way. And I think when it comes to advice, especially now, people get very, they personalize everything and then they project. And so even the best advice can be, you know, turned into something that's completely not good advice.
Absolutely.
So it's always about making sure that I believe firmly in when you take care of yourself, it doesn't mean you harm anybody else or you,
It feels like another angle on the conversation around boundaries.
Yes.
Like it's totally fine to have boundaries and you should, but people have stretched the definition of that word so that anything you do to someone else is labeled having a boundary and then it's okay. But that's not how it's supposed to work.
Not at all. Not at all. That's not what it's supposed to be about.
Okay, so don't apologize for taking care of yourself. I like that one.
Within reason.
within reason, important caveat. With that, Bassi and I will dive into your questions after a short break. Welcome back. You're listening to Dear Prudence, and I'm here with Bassi Ikpe. Let's get started with our first letter. It's titled Trip Troubles.
My sisters and I usually go on an extra special sisters trip every few years, usually by renting a place overseas for a month and exploring the local area. We each pay a third of the cost. My sister May got out of a very bad breakup last year. She and her former partner were together for a decade, which is why when May started dating Jay, I was happy. Jay is a single mom with two kids. We met her over the holidays. Her kids were with their dad. Jay basically bulldozed her way into our summer sister trip. She and her kids haven't had a vacation in years, and how nice would it be to bond with us all? The plans were to rent a two-bedroom house with a pull-out couch, and the three of us would rotate. My other sister and I reluctantly agreed that Jay and her kids would join in for the sake of May. We were under the impression that Jay would pay her own way. Nope. Jay expected that we would just eat the costs for her and her kids, and we would be exiled to the pullout the entire vacation because one of her kids is autistic and needs their private space. I told May I wasn't spending thousands of dollars to give her girlfriend a free vacation, and she needed to rethink the entire relationship if Jay was going to be a greedy grifter this early on. May got very upset with me and told Jay. The last day I was there, Jay got into my face and accused me of homophobia and ableism. I just looked at her and asked if she thought that, why did she want to go on a vacation with me then, other than to get a free trip? May is now demanding Jay and the kids come or she doesn't. I'm the one who already put down the non-refundable deposit. We have other people who would love to join my other sister and me on this trip. My other sister thinks that excluding May is going to fracture our relationship even further and give Jay more ammunition. At this point, I don't care. May has blinders on, and this train wreck is going to run out of tracks sooner or later. They had been dating for less than 5 months when this entire debacle happened. I need some outside advice.
Vassie, I'm just laughing because I was watching your face as we listened to the letter, and all you did was just look down and just gently shake your head back and forth.
It just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
It got worse and worse. And I want to kind of figure out where things went off the rails here. Let's go back to how this quote unquote bulldozing happened. Because letter writer, I really think you could have avoided all of this without the drama, without the hurt feelings. You had a precedent of sister trips with just sisters, not sisters and friends, not sisters and partners, not sisters and other people's kids. It would have been so easy and so fair to say, you know, no offense to Jay, we're happy you met someone you really like, but can we just keep it to sisters only? And maybe we can plan another trip with her once we get to know her better. Problem solved, right?
Clearly she wrote in instead of like figuring it out, which means that she probably has her own problems with boundaries and not being able to like stand up to her sister. That aside, that's some nerve. Like that is unbelievable nerve to, because I'm close to my siblings. And if we're saying, if I don't invite you to like come on this vacation with us personally, and you know it's a sister's trip, you know we've been doing it for decades. At a certain point, yes, I should have handled it differently, but I shouldn't have to have handled it at all because it shouldn't be on the table.
I mean, yeah, I guess I'm targeting the letter writer here because they're the person who asked, but it has to be said that Jay is out of control as a human.
Out of control, like the nerve, especially because you know it's a sister's trip. And here's the thing, you want to come along, okay. You want to bring your kids? You don't want to pay for anything?
The allegation that because someone doesn't want to sleep on the pullout couch and pay for you and include you and your children on this trip, that they're ableist and homophobic is just, you're reaching. Call her cheap, call her unwelcoming, but that just took it to another level. So now we have insults going back and forth. We have the letter writer saying, I'm not giving your girlfriend a free vacation. This is a greedy grifter. So that's where I think it really escalated to personal insults and attacks. It didn't have to come to the point where these personal insults were being hurled around, when really it just should have been a practical thing about the trip's been planned. There are only this many bedrooms. I'm not actually okay sleeping on the pullout couch the whole time.
Yeah.
Maybe next time. When it comes to these kind of things, when you have someone as unhinged as Jay and inconsiderate as May, you've got to let a writer at least pretend to be the bigger person.
Right.
You know, as a strategy, because then you put yourself in a position where you can't be insulted, or you at least have the peace of knowing you didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
But now that you've said, you know, you're greedy, you're a grifter, you just want a free vacation, now you're kind of down in the dirt with them. It goes without saying, third sister, the peacemaker who thinks everyone should go on the trip together. Sorry, you're wrong.
Yes.
People who really like each other have trouble traveling together. Traveling is tough. You're in close quarters. You've got to be on top of each other. You've got to compromise on plans. It often leads to fights and tension. You know, people say you can't travel with everyone. You absolutely do not want to go into a trip with someone you already are pissed off at. I mean, right. I could see law enforcement being involved by the end of this.
It seems like everybody has a heightened sort of space right now where no matter what is said, it's going to be taken wrong.
Yeah.
So being on a trip like that, it's not going to end well. It's not going to end well. So the sister who wants to be the peacemaker, girl, ain't no peace. Like,
no.
That ship has sailed. There is no peace.
The ship has completely sailed. It's not happening. Invite someone else, or even just do it with the two sisters. I don't know if you need someone else to help pay for it, but don't try to force this. There's no chance on earth that this trip would help repair your relationship with these people. I also just kind of want to add, I feel like there is, coming from the letter writer, a lot of sort of concern / judgment about May and Jay's relationship, and like whether it's legit, how new it is, how long it will last, how it's definitely going to fail, how May has kind of made a bad choice with this person. And just again, out of strategy, I want to suggest kind of keeping those judgments and concerns to yourself. Let your sister have the bad relationship she wants to have. Sounds like it's a rebound relationship. And don't be the person who's always being judgmental and negative, because that's just going to alienate you even further. You have enough material to fight with your sister about, given that she's inconsiderate and pushy and cheap. Again, you don't want to give her reason to see you as the bad guy for being super critical on top of everything.
And I would also add that you should probably think about the fact that 10 years is a long time. And you probably have a relationship with that person, and you probably have a loyalty to that person. Yeah. So I think a lot of the advanced animosity has a lot probably to do with the previous relationship and how they feel there. But that said, it's still out of line. It's still out of pocket, but I can understand there's some sort of loyalty or, because she didn't say anything about she didn't say you're continuously, she's always, it's this right. particular relationship doesn't feel like it's good. And I think that's a conversation to have with your sister later, not on vacation.
Not on vacation. You're listening to the Dear Prudence Show. And when we come back, we'll be reading more of your letters. Stay with us. Welcome back to Dear Prudence. I'm here with my guest, Bassi Ikpe, to answer your letters. And the next one is titled, Can't Deal With It Anymore.
My wife and I have been married for 40 years, and the first 25 were great. About 15 years ago, though, both of our work lives were changing. Our teenagers had normal issues and then left. Menopause hit, and my wife's behavior slowly began to change. This is something our kids noticed as well. Just negativity, periodic rages in which she verbally assaults me, Karen-like behavior in public, significant weight loss, self-esteem issues, etc. It was a gradual buildup that me and the kids tiptoed around, but the past few years were very intense. Several medical physicals happened during this time, but no issues were noted. A few months ago, she had a full psychotic break, resulting in 3 law enforcement encounters and ER visits in 10 days. At the first ER visit, the psychiatrist diagnosed her as paranoid delusional, but not a threat, and so discharged her. The third diagnosed her as bipolar and a danger to herself, resulting in an involuntary admission for 2 weeks. Once out, my wife quit all of her meds and either denies or deflects when anything is said about her behavior that scared and hurt a lot of people with her words and actions. She won't seek therapy. She's gone no contact with our daughter and grandson, as she blames her for calling the police the first time, and blames me for causing all her problems and also signing off on the involuntary stay. She's angry I've taken my daughter's side, but I can't simply agree with her just because she's my wife. I want to honor my vows to take care of her in sickness and in health, but I just can't deal with it anymore if she won't even try. Her verbal abuse has caused me to spiral downward in the past with 2 close calls for suicide and a 4-day voluntary stay in a mental ward. Am I wrong to seek a divorce and never see her again, as it would be too painful for me because I still love her?
So, it occurs to me that one of the harder things about mental illness is that it can make you not want to seek treatment for mental illness. So when the letter writer says she won't even try, I get it. But I wonder if the standard for trying looks different in a situation when someone actually cannot try because of where they are. What do you think?
As somebody who personally struggles or lives with, I don't struggle anymore, that lives with a mental illness, specifically bipolar disorder, I feel like at some point I realized that it was my responsibility to make sure that I was healthy and to make sure that to my ability, the people around me weren't suffering because I was going through something. Right. I think that in this situation, because of the number of times they've tried, the number of times they've done what they could possibly do, you don't get the right to terrorize everybody else because you personally don't want to get help, especially to the point where the letter writer is also now suffering from a mental health issue because of the situation. At some point, it has to be save myself. And that means I tell people all the time when I ask questions about how to deal with, how to help, you specifically could go to therapy and figure out what it is about what you're going through that makes you feel so torn and feel like you should live with bad treatment because somebody else that you love is doing it. There's a conversation to be had there. If somebody else's behavior has pushed you so far that you are now also going into to seek treatment, it's one or the other. You can burn yourself out for somebody else, or you can figure out the best way to take care of yourself, and then you can take care of that person better.
Right. So when I first read the letter, I think it didn't quite click for me that the 2 close suicide calls and the 4-day stay in the mental health ward at the end of the letter were for the letter writer. He was the one who went through those things. So that kind of just became clear to me when we heard it read out loud. So at this point, letter writer, I think what might make you feel better is the idea that you actually probably don't have what it takes to provide a lot of support for your wife right now. It would be wonderful if you did, but you're deeply struggling. And I mean, you've got to prioritize yourself first, because what are you really going to do to help her get better and support her as her husband if you yourself are really barely holding on? And I imagine for your kids, you want them to have at least one parent who's well, right? And so maybe it just has to be you.
Exactly. Especially if you have the wherewithal to understand where you're going through and what you can do to help support yourself and support your family and support your daughter and grandchild. You have that.
I've come around to agree that the letter writer has to prioritize himself and take care of himself. But I wonder what that means for the actual question of divorce, which just seems really permanent to me. So you said in an interview about your book, which was about your experience navigating bipolar, you said, "I was hoping that people would walk away saying this is a continuous process. It doesn't end. And instead of it not ending, being a horrible, daunting life sentence, it's actually just part of life. There's no judgment placed on it." So I wonder how that perspective could kind of guide the letter writer's decision about whether to cut this woman off and never talk to her again, as he suggests, or stay totally invested. Is there a middle ground here?
Absolutely. There's absolutely a middle ground. I was shocked when he got to the end and the writer said, "And I'll never speak to her again." So, whoa,
right.
there's a whole bridge that you need to cross. I'll say again, I think that the letter writer needs to get therapy and figure out what it is that's, I don't want to say enabling, because we only have this short space to think about. But after a certain time, so somebody you've been married to for long enough to have a child and grandchild, I think a lot of people, and I know this from personal experience, a lot of people have trouble with the mental illness part. Right. They can handle, "Your behavior is affecting me in this way," or "Your behavior feels like this thing." But when you put a mental illness on it, people automatically block. "No, I don't. Mm. You're trying to call me crazy. I don't want to have this conversation." And they shut down completely. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if they were to go to counseling together or therapy together, and he goes to therapy separately, there's a way to have that conversation. And if you have that conversation coming from a different angle and it still doesn't affect her or make her want to make any changes or to get healthy, the answer is not divorce and never speak to her again. There's a separation. Right. Giving that space might also jumpstart like her thinking, "Oh yeah. My God, I am by myself. My daughter's not speaking to me. My grandchild and my husband is now separating, not divorcing, but separating himself. It can't be everybody." At some right. point, you need to reflect. And I hope that something like that would make her reflect on how she got here. But again, I'm pro therapy. I'm pro figuring out how to navigate the world. What brought you to a place that you think that this is your option is to stay and get abused, or to leave mm-hmm. and completely abandon?
Right.
You need to figure out why those are your two choices.
And I'd say, in addition to therapy, I hope there's some kind of community support or support group on Zoom for family members of people living with mental illness, because it's really, really hard. I don't want to oversimplify this letter at all. I think it's a heartbreaking and really, really difficult situation, but you're not the only one who's there.
Yeah.
I think you want to talk to other people who understand that there's love there too. You love the person she is, and you're trying to figure out how to balance that with protecting and taking care of yourself.
Yeah, it's the love that kept you there. It's the love that you've worked through, hoping that she will get the help that she needs. So you can't just abandon that love. It's not going to be good for you either. I don't think divorcing right. and never speaking to her is going to be mentally or emotionally stable for you as well. So
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Dear Prudence. We need to take a break, but when we come back, more letters from you and advice from us. Stay tuned. I'm Janae, and you're listening to Dear Prudence. Bassie and I are about to tackle our last question for the day. Ready, Bassie?
I'm ready. I am ready for this one.
I hoped you would be, because I was kind of like, I'll just turn it over to her. This letter is titled, "It's Not You, It's Me."
I found myself in an uncomfortable situation with a coworker that I'm not sure how to manage. When I was first hired at the company years ago, she was senior to me and routinely took out her stress and frustration on me, doing some serious damage to my professional self-confidence along the way. Once I got out of her immediate orbit, I was able to blossom and become valued as a productive, capable, confident employee at work. In the past year, she was transferred to my team, and while I was not thrilled, I figured she would be easy enough to avoid since our job duties do not at all overlap. I was wrong. She immediately wanted to have a social relationship, and she seemed to take my extremely professional and polite, thanks for the invite, but I've been really into my audiobook recently, and I'd love to just take the morning walk to the conference solo with my coffee, very personally. She has asked not one but two colleagues directly if they thought I didn't like her, they told me, and has apparently taken to watching my body language at group lunches to see how I'm reacting to her presence. She told them this as well. Aside from my feeling bad that she's dragging other colleagues into a personal issue, this extreme social pressure and feeling observed slash analyzed makes me want to be around her even less. I became a bit of a recluse, not socializing with anyone, just to make sure she didn't feel singled out by my avoidance. But it came to a head this week when she came to me in my office in the middle of the workday, asking for a minute to chat. Assuming that she had a professional question, I followed her to the conference room. Instead, I was blindsided with a speech about being a people pleaser and wanting to know what she'd done and offering to go to mediation. I managed to deflect with an, "It's not you, it's me, I just don't socialize at work," but it left me feeling very uncomfortable and too upset to keep working that day. I sent a very dry follow-up email a few days later saying that she could come to me with professional concerns, but that personal concerns were inappropriate in the workplace, and explicitly saying that the interaction made me uncomfortable. But I'm at a loss when it comes to next steps. Should I involve my manager? I mostly sent the email to make sure I had a paper trail if she tries something similar again so that I could go to HR. But at this point, her presence causes me stress at work. Any insight would be appreciated.
So you can tell me if you agree, but I read this thinking the letter writer has done almost everything right so far. I thought the audiobook and coffee solo morning walk line was brilliant, perfect. Yeah. So was the, "It's not you, it's me, I just really don't socialize at work" excuse. I thought the follow-up email was pretty smart, probably exactly what I would have advised. And it just goes to show that even if you have the perfect script and you do everything right, some people are just still going to be out of control.
First of all, I was like, is it Jay? Because a lot of boundaries being crossed. This was so strange to me because, and I was thinking about it, like I've never really worked in an office setting before. Mm-hmm. The one time I did, it was very loosey-goosey media. This was years ago. So I was like, is this normal behavior? And I started thinking, it's like, was it a relationship? It just felt like a Lifetime movie where a relationship happened and then they decided, or one of them decided to end it. Like it felt very intimate for her right. Just to be a stranger.
I think it's unusual, but I also think it was more usual in pre-pandemic. Everyone goes into the office and you're expected to socialize and do happy hour and do holiday parties times. I mean, I've worked in a lot of offices, and including ones where socializing was very much expected. So I can kind of get it. I definitely have been places where I would not have felt it was okay to turn down a lunch invitation or not talk to a certain person. And I think that's wrong. I think we're all better off working from home if we can and not putting all that energy into all those relationships with people we didn't choose that don't serve the bottom line. But I did find myself wondering, I guess, based on my past experience, if there's room for a little bit of being fake here, a little bit of giving this one what she wants and fake friendliness as an alternative to totally isolating yourself from everyone and becoming a hermit to prove the point that you don't socialize at work. Because at some point, I mean, if you're working in an office, it's because you work for a place that where the leaders believe you're there to build community and talking to each other and getting to know one another is important. So you're not serving yourself well if you don't talk to anyone, simply to normalize not talking to this woman.
Ordinarily, I would agree wholeheartedly. But I think that after it's gotten to the point where this one person, it's not like they're not asking about different people, you know, on the floor, in their department, whatever. They're not asking about different people who are having these conversations and they're trying to avoid all of them. It's one person. It's weird. I'm sorry. It's
one person who honestly has risen to the level of stalkerish.
Yes. Like, how much time do you have?
Yeah.
How much time do you have to, like, folk, the whole body language thing, the talking to other coworkers? Right. That is strange behavior.
I wonder if there's, like, a romantic crush involved.
This is what I'm wondering. I told you it's a Lifetime
movie. It does feel like it's fueled by something else, right?
There's something missing there. Sorry, letter writer, I don't want to call you a liar. And I don't, I'm not calling you a liar. But I feel like there's a chunk. There's a sizable chunk missing. Because for this one person to be so obsessed with you, like, mm-hmm. why are you so obsessed with me? Like, there's not, I'm not victim blaming. I know it's difficult, but I feel like there is a half a paragraph that you took out because it was incriminating. Because this is very strange behavior for every part of this is like, mm-hmm. oh, that's going to, but to, in combination, bringing other people right. into it, watching body language.
Right.
There's a lot.
So I will say, letter writer, especially the bringing other people into it part, I don't think you have to be too worried about your reputation or how this will come back to hurt you, because this, your coworker has shown multiple other people in the office that she's not professional, weird, and like I said, out of control.
Yeah.
And again, you've done everything right. You've been professional. You've been poised. You've been clear. You've been fair. So I'm not super worried about this harming your career, I don't think. But I also don't suggest involving your manager or HR. Now, Bassie, I know you haven't worked in a lot of traditional workplaces, but my theory after working in them is that you don't call on your manager or HR for stuff that you're having a tough time with and trying to make life better for you, because they represent the company and the company's interests. You call on them for something that's going to help them prevent a lawsuit, right? So if you're being sexually harassed, racially harassed, absolutely go to them. They can take action. If you're going to them with, this person has a bad personality and is annoying me, there's probably not a lot they can do. And you're just going to look like you're part of the drama, I think.
Again, I feel like half a paragraph was left out. Have they tried just simply saying, you know what? I'm not interested in being friends. We work together. I want to make sure that our working relationship is good. And she didn't say that the working relationship wasn't good. It's like personal stuff.
Right.
So being very clear right. about, I like working with you. We work well together or whatever. But on a personal level, I don't think we're compatible. Or I have friends outside, something. And it also sounds like your coworker sounds like, again, there's something going on with them. Right. That they feel this need to be friends. Do they think that, you know, being close to you is going to get them a promotion? Like, just being very clear about the way you work and the way you work personally and professionally. Just, I'm non-confrontational, but sometimes you just have to say it straight. I do not, I will not, thank you so much. But all the excuses just sound like excuses, because they are. And they're not taking it, you know, they think they can win you over.
But the minute you say something that isn't an excuse and that's closer to the truth and it is personal, which is, I don't think we're compatible. You treated me really poorly when I was first hired and I don't want to be friends with you. Then you've insulted her. And now she can go to whoever and say, you know, letter writer said she didn't like me. Letter writer said I was a bad person. So I just don't want to give coworker any ammunition. That's why I like the sort of general dry excuses. Even though they're not really working, I don't want to give her anything to sink her teeth into, complain about, or God forbid, cry about.
Oh, God. I'll leave that to grown folks' business. I've never, I personally am just like, you're getting on my nerves.
I also think it seems like a huge step, but don't close off the possibility of looking for a new job. You know,
this
people get
extreme.
Laid off and switch jobs all the time.
Yeah.
Your job doesn't have to be forever. There are a lot of reasons to look elsewhere.
Yeah.
And this should just be a huge bullet point on the list of reasons to update your LinkedIn and think about moving on. It's not fair to you because you didn't do anything wrong. But the fact is, you're now suffering all this stress and dreading going into work. And work just shouldn't stress you out in ways that go beyond
not
work.
Not like this.
You have the rest of your life for that.
Yes. Leave the job and never speak to them again. You have the right to jump from A to Z, whereas the other person can, like, gradually, there's a place in between. This is extreme.
It could be a sign to move on. Not that you shouldn't have to and you don't have to, but just ask yourself whether you might be happier in an environment where you didn't have this unhinged person who's obsessed with you.
Yeah.
Those are all the questions we have for this week. It's been fun, sometimes depressing, and hopefully helpful. Thank you so much, Bassie.
Thank you. Bucket list check.
Loved, loved, loved having you here. Follow Bassie on Instagram and Twitter at BassieWorld to keep up with her work and latest projects. Do you need help getting along with partners, relatives, coworkers, and people in general? Write to me. Go to slate.com/Prudy. That's slate.com/PRUDIE. The Dear Prudence column publishes every Thursday.
If you'd like to hear your question answered on the podcast, we are looking for letter writers who would be comfortable recording their questions for the show. You can stay anonymous.
Dear Prudence is produced by Sierra Spragley Ricks and me, Janae Desmond Harris, with a special thanks to Maura Curry. Editorial help from Paola De Verona. Daisy Rosario is senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's VP of audio. I'm your Dear Prudence, Janae Desmond Harris. Until next time. Thank you so much for being a Slate Plus member. And since you're a member, you get the awesome perk of a weekly segment where I'll be answering an extra question. That's right, you get even more Prudy. This week, writer and mental health advocate Bassie Ikpe stuck around to answer an extra question just for our Prudy Plus listeners. She's the author of the New York Times bestselling essay collection, I'm Telling the Truth But I'm Lying, and the Audible original, Home Rarely Feels Like This. This letter is titled, Not My Business.
I recently learned a former friend of mine was admitted to a mental hospital. I have many problems of my own, and I've been trying to gently pull away from that relationship for some time. I want to practice empathy, but still maintain my distance when mutual friends bring it up. Is there a way to gracefully step out of those conversations, or am I just being a jerk?
My first thought when I read this was, damn, you can't even handle listening to your friend talk about a mutual friend having a crisis. No one is asking you to go visit this person, house this person, pay this person's medical bills. I am actually going to mostly turn it over to you, but the reason I picked this was because I know you've done work to reduce mental health stigma, and I imagine this is almost the exact kind of consequence of stigma that you hope people can avoid.
Yeah.
You seek treatment for your mental health, which is the right thing to do, and suddenly people don't want to be around you or even talk to you. It's messed up.
Yeah. It sounded to me that first of all, letter writer, you are a jerk. But it sounds to me like, because when they said, I have problems of my own, it was very dismissive. They didn't say, I have mental health issues of my own. They said.
We all have many problems.
We all got pain is basically what they said. And I think that if it gets to the point where you're writing in to an advice show to ask or confirm whether or not you're doing the right thing, you're doing the wrong thing, especially in a situation like this. Again, like you said, they're not asking you to go and take care of this person and be physically around them. You just don't want to hear somebody else talking about them to the point where you're just fed up.
Which is also being a bad, being a jerk to your other friends too.
Yeah.
This is what they're dealing with right now. And you can't even listen.
Yeah. And the issue is not because they said that lacking empathy. It's not about empathy. You lack compassion. And compassion is what you would need. Empathy is when you put yourself in the person's shoes. Okay, you can't do that. You can't fathom that. But compassion is, I don't understand what this person is going through, but I feel something for them. And I want to listen to my other friend talk about it. They're not calling you 24/7. It's not like a constant thing. But the first thing I thought when I read, you're a jerk. The way that you've handled this, just the way, not even the way that you handled it. I can only imagine the way that they're handling it if this is the letter that they sent in.
Right. And I'll add too, this is just beyond the question of whether you're a jerk, this is not the way you want to live.
Right.
Life has a lot of ebbs and flows. Friendships have a lot of ebbs and flows. There are going to be a lot of times when you're the person listening. There are going to be a lot of times where you're the person who has the stress and the complaints and the worry about someone else, and you need people to listen. And there are going to be the times when you're the person who's going through a really, really bad time and needs people to support you and needs those people to be able to talk to other people to get support. So just don't think that you're always going to be the person who like has their own problems and just doesn't want to deal with anyone else. The roles are going to shift throughout the course of these friendships and throughout your life. And it's just, it's not smart to be a person who pulls back and walks away whenever things are hard for someone else, because no one's going to be there for you when things are hard for you.
Especially when the difficulty is just listening. That's the right. Part that I, not even listening to that person, listening to somebody else talk about that person.
Nobody's asking you to donate an organ, do a GoFundMe. It's really like the lowest possible friendship action. And no one's even asking you to actively check in and ask questions. Just simply listen. I think you can do this. And I think you should want to do this. And I think it might make you a better person to do this.
I agree. Because the person that wrote that letter, I don't think you want to be that person. If you do want to be that person, that's a totally different issue. Mm-hmm.
But if you wanted to be that person, you wouldn't have written this letter. They would have just been a proud jerk. Exactly. You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you again for being a Slate Plus member. The Dear Prudence podcast would not be possible without you. Until next time.